and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Welcome back, listeners. Well, as I always promise you, we're bringing you the experts from the world of triathlon. And today, I've got a fellow coach. In fact, he's a fellow Brit, although he resides on the other side of the pond, on the other side of the island, on the other side of the pond over in, I think you're in California, aren't you? Matt Dixon. So welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks so much, Simon. I appreciate you. In San Francisco as we speak, actually.
Wow. I bet the weather's not cooling down quite as quickly as it is over here in the UK.
Still very nice. It's our summer over here, basically.
Yeah, lovely. Well, so for those of you who can detect a sort of a hint of the UK accent, Matt was indeed from the UK. He went across to the United States on a sports scholarship as a swimmer, in fact. And after his swimming career ended, or when he decided to end it, he fell into the world of triathlon, raced as a pro triathlete, and then with his physiology degree, he entered the world of triathlon coaching, where today you will find him as co-owner and the founder of Purple Patch. Is it Purple Patch Fitness?
You call it? It is Purple Patch Fitness, that's right, yeah.
So this is Matt Dixon. I'm going to let Matt take up the story there. So perhaps you can start off with your swimming background, Matt, because that sounds quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we were chatting before we came on the show. You know, the two spots on the Olympic team that I was trying to take were mostly cohabitated by ex-swimmers Adrian Morehouse and Nick Gillingham. So I think my chances of truly making the British squad were pretty limited. But yeah, I was very lucky. I mean, I'm originally from South End in Essex. So an Essex boy of all things. And I left in the early 90s. To head off for a sports scholarship. And I just thought, well, this is a wonderful opportunity to, number one, try and make the Olympic team, but number two, go and get a degree in another country. And so it was a magical experience and obviously a great learning experience for me. And after I finished swimming in 96, that was where I got my coaching start, which was really important to me as a coach, was actually in age group swimming. I got to have a work at a very, very good amateur team over here, club program, that were national champions. And so my first coaching experience was really anchored around swimming coaching, actually.
How was that experience then fared you for working in triathlon? Was that a good experience working in the world of swimming, or did it sort of highlight a lot of the bad things about the way coaching perhaps was run back in the 90s?
Interestingly, I would say both. The first part was of the coaches that I've really sort of met over my journey as a coach, the head coach at that time, a guy called Ed Barkman, who is not famous in the swimming world, but I still see as one of my best mentors in coaching. I just thought he was a wonderful coach. And at the same time, and the other part of it that was really positive, I would say, was something that all aspiring coaches should do, which is to really get their hands dirty on real coaching. So managing 30 athletes from 13 years of age up to 18 years of age with very lofty aspirations themselves trying to go on to swimming scholarships over here. It's a wonderful coaching experience. But when I look back, you know, our swimming program that I came out of was a high volume. We were swimming 25 to 27 hours a week of swimming training each week. And that still manifested itself in the sport globally. And so when I look back, more at the sessions that I was prescribing at the time.
Yeah, well, I worked, so you mentioned Adrian Morehouse there. He was based in Leeds, where I'm based, and his coach was Terry Dennison. And similar to Ed Bachman that you mentioned there, Terry, I worked with Terry's squad before the Sydney Olympics as their strength and conditioning coach. So that had James Hickman and Claire Huddart, who performed quite highly. And Terry's a wonderful coach, got a great reputation. And Leeds City was probably the best swim club in Britain for maybe the 15 years around that, you know, leading up to 2000 while Terry was there. But even then, you know, so 4 or 5 years after you're talking about that this high volume of swim training was still there. And it, as a strength and conditioning coach, where it puzzled me why somebody who was swimming an event that lasted 2 minutes would need to spend 20 to 25 hours a week in the pool.
It doesn't make any logical sense, does it? And yet that was the world we lived in, you know?
Well, Terry explained it to me very eloquently as he was able to do, in that you know, because swimming is such an alien situation to be in for human beings, that 80% of the time you're in the water, you were really finding your feel and learning how to become efficient in the breathing, and only 20% of it was real, hardcore conditioning. But still, as you and I both know, and I'm sure most of our listeners do, if you're training, regardless of what you do, it's causing stress and fatigue, and you have to recover from that.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, I know that we'll probably talk about recovery today, but swimming as a sport has evolved greatly, as much as probably any other sport over the last 15 years or so. And if you look at a swimming program for some of the top programs now, it's radically different than it was when I was a puppy and I was competing, which is a good thing. And so, you know, I think it has evolved greatly with the lens on that as people have got smarter.
Well, you mentioned recovery there, Matt, and I know that within the industry, particularly in the US, you're well known as the recovery coach. And I would like to get onto that in a minute and focus on that. But just from 96 then, how did you get to the position where you're at today with your triathlon coaching? When did you found Purple Patch?
So Purple Patch started actually at the out of the ashes of my own professional career. So I went on and started clinical physiology. And it was when I was doing my master's that I fell into triathlon, and much like many other athletes, fell in love with the sport. And I love the multidisciplinary approach to it, the challenge of obviously something that came something more natural to me, the bike riding, and then the thing that didn't come naturally to me, running. And I was very lucky that I managed to evolve to a place that I could compete professionally. But I think I'm a great example, perhaps a prime example, of how to do a professional triathlon career really poorly. I took the work ethic that I took from swimming and thinking, you know, goodness me, if I had to train 25 hours a week to get ready for a 2-minute swimming event, despite having known, should have known better, how long do I have to train to get ready for this Ironman thing? And with the help of some very poor coaching, I basically trained myself into the ground. And so while I had some humble success to sort of begin, after 2 or 3 years, I basically fell into a state of, for lack of a better phrase, chronic fatigue. And my career was over. And it was sort of like, you know, this very sort of undefinable thing. What is deep fatigue? But it was enough that I was absolutely unable to exercise for a couple of years, didn't exercise once. And so there I was, sort of this end of a triathlon career that never even really happened, a swimming career behind me, but I had a backbone of clinical physiology, master's degree, coaching experience, and this years of elite sort of sporting experience. And I just looked at the state of triathlon at the time, which is now going back 15 years or so, and I just thought, this is madness. And what I saw was chronic underperformance across the sport, both at the elite level, but particularly for amateurs that were trying to juggle this demanding sport within a time-starved life. And so it was really at that crossroads of my own life that it forced me to take a step back, look at the landscape of the sport, and I just thought there's got to be a smarter, more pragmatic way. And I'll remind you, the sport at that time, particularly in the US, the obsession was just with the accumulation of hours, more, 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 and much as like my own swimming career was, and concepts like recovery or nutrition or fueling or even strength and conditioning were pure lip service. And so I just decided to start going about it a different way. And I started coaching athletes, and I was committed to still having a saying that our purple patch athletes know. I wanted our athletes to be fit and fresh. And I have a whole bunch of silly Dixonisms, but one of them that really lives on that we're passionate about is I want you to be fit and fresh, because for so many competing athletes, fitness is never the limiter, and they're showing up to the races fit and fatigued. And so that was really the start of coaching. We started to have a lot of initial success with a wide range of athletes. And I was very lucky to start to work with some professional triathletes, much, much better athletes than I ever was. And I decided to adopt a methodology that became very, very strong, really putting focus across the multiple elements of performance, not just swim, bike, and run. And our results sort of blossomed, and it sort of became natural that I would start my own company, and that has become Purple Patch, basically.
Going on to your pillars of performance, let's just rewind to what you said there about triathlon and the tendency of athletes, both age group and professionals, to do too much. Do you think, you know, I was listening to some of the conversations after Kona this year about some of the pros, and it seems that some of those are not taking on board your lessons there, Matt, and still overdoing it, coming right into the biggest race of the year.
You know, I mean, Hawaii is a beast in itself. It's a very, very hard race to get right, because it's the world championships. It's very emotional, but you're also doing this event in the harshest possible environment that you can. Everything from the swim being in warmer water than you would like. Obviously the potential winds, there were no winds this year, and the heat, humidity. It's just an occasion. The natural human tendency is, you're racing the best athletes in the world, particularly at the elite level, is to just do a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And, you know, managing the heat, trying to get a little bit lighter, a little bit lighter, a little bit lighter. And the pattern is consistent. The athletes that have the great races there are the ones that quite often have gone through years with a little bit of adversity, where perhaps they haven't been able to, for one reason or another, overtrain themselves, and have come in and sort of uncorked some really magical performances. Or athletes that have just shown up resisting the natural urge to just overdo it. And it's a very, very hard race. If it was in a different environment, and you see that all the time with the 70.3 worlds, which is much more predictable, performances would be more predictable. But yeah, it is a race where consistently we see athletes come in, overtrained is the wrong word, but overtrained relative to the ultimate demands of the sport.
Yeah, I think Sebastian Keenly summed it up quite well. He said it's better to be a little bit undercooked than overcooked, didn't he? And, you know, certainly with Kona, resting up a bit more, particularly if you've been racing earlier in the year as well, and you've accumulated a couple of Ironman races under your belt already, that accumulation of fatigue can suddenly show up when you least want it to, in the sort of the pointy end of the race when you have to put the hammer down.
It's true. And, you know, if we just dissect and we only look at those people that are truly the world-class athletes, so those that are either really trying to win there, get on the podium as an age group, but more importantly, professional athletes. Across the professional athletes, it is very, very rare, you would actually say it's never, the fact that fitness, global fitness, is the performance limiter. So of those athletes that blew up in Hawaii, none of them is because they were lazy and out of shape. And the vast majority of it's either poor pacing relative to their resources, but typically it's because they've carried in an accumulation of deeper fatigue relative to what the sport asks of them. And I think it's the most common fact. So, you know, Sebastian's comment there of being underdone is so often we see it, and even down at the lower level, you see so many magical performances that come out of perceived adversity, but that adversity has created a chance to recuperate a little bit. And uh-huh. And even in the half Ironman level, you know, a couple of years ago, I remember 10 days out of the race, our athlete Tim ended up, you know, thankfully winning the race and becoming world champion. But 10 days out, he had a head cold, 3 or 4 days of rest. And the great thing about Tim is he managed to keep his mind clear. But that probably ultimately, bizarrely, was probably quite helpful to him having the day.
I don't know if you're familiar with Andrew McNaughton. He was racing on the pro scene back in the 90s, but he has this phrase that triathletes and endurance athletes are much more comfortable and happy being in a state of overtraining and being slightly tired and fatigued than they are in a state of being rested and you know, ready to rumble. And I'd sort of like to move on to this title you've assumed, probably because of the way you shape your coaching as the recovery coach, and talk about why you feel that that's an important first principle of everything you do rather than something that gets added in later when you've done all the hard work.
Yeah, I think it's, by the way, if I have assumed this name, it's not always in a complimentary fashion.
I was going to ask you about that as well, because I have some friends who've had chronic fatigue and some athletes I've coached who had chronic fatigue before I started working with them. And I've seen this firsthand, and I'm acutely aware of just how much stress most triathletes have in their life. And so trying to program in recovery has often led to me losing athletes who just want to hammer themselves and don't appreciate the fact that you're trying to look after their health in the long term.
Yeah, exactly. So let me explain my mindset like this, Simon, and then perhaps we'll sort of get somewhere and go on a journey. But I think the first thing that we have to appreciate is that if you value recovery as a coach or an athlete, this is not a route to a shortcut to success. So we have to first acknowledge this is a really tough sport that is demanding, that the only route to success is consistent, very, very hard work. But in addition to that, I believe that in order for that work to be effective, your body has to be able to adapt in a positive manner. So your body will always adapt to stress, and it's either going to adapt in a positive way, get stronger, fitter, more powerful, or in a negative way, get suppressed, get injured, etc. And so the mission of training is not to get as fit as you can, and it's not to accumulate as much work as you can. It's to maximize training load while achieving positive adaptations. And if you're a professional athlete, what we do is we're basically, across all athletes, we're playing a game of stress management. And as a professional athlete, the quest, in my mind, the way that I look at it as a coach, is you are a professional athlete. Your mission is world-class performance. And so with those, it's unapologetic world-class performance. And we take as much as we can the elements of stress in life and we try and suppress them. So most of them don't work. We prioritize sleep. We prioritize nutrition and fueling. And it's more of a monk's life, yeah? It's not romantic, but it is more of a monk's life if you are truly trying to be a world-class athlete. But the vast majority of people that are doing this sport, in my mind, you're looking to integrate the sport into a very big life and still improve, but not at the expense of your health, your ability to work, and the version of yourself that you bring to your friends and family. And the game of stress management for the vast majority of people, amateurs, is much more challenging because you have unavoidable stresses in life that have an impact on our body's ability to absorb the training. So we have life stress, you have travel for work, you have family commitments, you have a limited time. And so by prioritizing recovery, it's not about a shortcut to do more, but it's more of a pragmatic mindset to say, this is a part of the program. It's not an afterthought. You have to, and in fact, you add into that elements like nutrition and strength and conditioning, why we call them the pillars of performance. And rather than just starting and ending the conversation with swimming, cycling, running, we actually say the program is your endurance training plus recovery. And yeah, it's not for everyone, but ultimately it is a huge catalyst of once an athlete buys into it, it shifts really their lens, I think, in many ways.
Ah, fantastic. Sorry, apologies, listeners, if it sounds like I'm living in a war zone here. It's bonfire night. I forgot about that when we'd arranged the call, Matt. And some of you probably don't get any more in the US. But right now, right here, it sounds like I'm in Beirut. it seems like there's a ceasefire at the moment. You talk quite a bit about your pro athletes, Matt. And I guess, as you say, it's because most of them aren't working, it's a little bit easy for them to manage the stress in their life, but I guess most of our listeners will be age group athletes, and they will have those challenges that you mentioned, life, travel, work, and all of the other stuff that goes on around them trying to fit in their training. So maybe we can focus a little bit more about how you help your age group athletes, who I guess a lot of them you're probably not seeing, are you, on a regular basis? So how do you help them manage their own stress, and how do you dip into what they're doing through use of Training Peaks, for example, and help them to manage it with some guidance and mentoring?
Yeah, some very practical steps. So we have a training squad here in San Francisco. We have unavoidable challenges that interrupt our ability to train. So we have work, we have family, everything that comes along with it. And so I think the first piece of the equation is the lens that you look through when you're building your program. And when I look at it, I will look at many coaches out there and athletes out there. I think it's an incorrect way to look at planning, where they say, this is the plan. And they have some mythical sort of set and very rigid structure to build a training program that they think is necessary to be successful, to achieve the goals, get ready for a half Ironman, get ready for an Ironman. And that program might be, let's say, 15 hours a week or 20 hours a week, whatever it might be. And then the athlete is asked, or the coach tries to force that training program into life. And it's not sustainable, because ultimately something has to give. So instead, you take a different approach, where you approach the challenge from more of an optimization mindset. So let's first have a really honest conversation about the landscape of your life. When do you need to work? What are your responsibilities for your family? When can we prioritize sleep? There's a part of the recovery occasion or operation. And really get an honest appraisal. And as an outcome of that conversation or process, you have how many hours you have available on a weekly basis. And that might be 8 or 10 or 12 or 14 or 30, whatever it is. But then the challenge is, with those hours available, how do I optimize and create a training program? And so if you look at a purple patch athlete, we don't say you've got to try and get 15 hours a week, or you've got to get 20 hours a week. Instead, we look at just how many hours that you realistically have as a baseline number, and then we build the training program into that. So straight away, you have a sustainable program. And then a second tier to it then, which I think is of equal importance, is to empower the athlete not to look at the training program as just a static spreadsheet. We have another silly saying, life is not a spreadsheet. So instead, you first build any training program around the key sessions that are the ones that are designed to move the performance needle in any given week. So what are the do not miss foundational sessions? And we call them that, key sessions. And then in support of those, you have a revolutionary naming style, supporting sessions. So there's a hierarchy. And what that empowers the athletes is to look at their week and say, okay, I've got 12 hours a week. These are the 12 hours. But even within that 12 hours, what are the ones that I can move around and make sure that I nail? They're the performance needle. They're the key sessions. And then supporting sessions, if life does get in the way, if life does bring logistical challenges, I know the ones that I can scale back, reduce the intensity, or, by the time, eliminate in order for me to still move forward and not regress and still hit the key sessions. And over the long term, if you approach that with that lens, what it empowers athletes to shift the mindset is a pass-fail approach to hitting every session. So I think that the limiting mindset is to be ready, I have to hit every session or I'm gonna fail. And that leads athletes to compromise sleep, compromise fueling habits, cram sessions in when maybe their body's not ready to absorb it. And so I don't even count the accumulated training hours for most of our amateurs. We focus on getting the key sessions, getting as many of the supporting sessions as is reasonably practical, and stringing it together over many, many weeks, many, many months. And ultimately, they arrive to races where they're emotionally enthusiastic, but also physiologically healthy and fresh. And that tends to be a better recipe for performance globally. I sound like a salesman, but hopefully that concept at least makes sense.
Well, so what I'm hearing there is something that we teach on the triathlon coaching program in the UK, which is an athlete-centered approach to planning. So I fully hear what you're saying about coaches who say, right, well, this is the template, you know, this is what you do or you can't do it. But there is a disconnect sometimes between athlete thinking, perhaps even before they get to you, Matt, in that they there seems to be a move now to dismissing shorter distance racing as just, you know, an insignificance, and that only Ironman is important. And so they want to get there as quick as possible to doing their Ironman. And before they've even taken those steps that you mentioned there of looking at their own landscape and everything, what they do is decide that they're going to do this Ironman race, and then they come to you and they want you and all your expertise to somehow shoehorn the appropriate training into time they don't have available. And I guess that either results in an uncomfortable conversation at the start, or if the athlete persists, then frustration that you mention at some point down the line when they realize that everything's not going to fit. Is that a situation that you recognize, and does that happen more often than not?
Yeah, yes. And I think that, you know, I'll say a couple of things to it. The first is that coaching, I don't believe that coaching is just the prescription of workouts. It can only be effective if the athlete understands the mission behind those workouts. And so a part of a coaching's job is to prescribe a smart and appropriate training program for the athlete and their life and their situation to enable them to progress. But then educate, that word is really important, educate the athlete on the mission and the why of what they're looking to achieve. And it's only then that if an athlete understands and buys into that, they're then going to execute the program as intended. So a part of that is shifting perceptions. Last year I was down at a triathlon club, San Diego Triathlon Club, and I was being interviewed by a person that's well known in the sport, Bob Babbitt, a wonderful guy, and we probably had 150 people in the room or so, and he asked me a question related to this, and I asked for a show of hands and people to call out in the audience, and I said, how many hours do you think it's necessary for you to be successful as an amateur athlete, to be successful in half Ironman or Ironman performance? And the range of hours a week that were thrown out were 17 hours, 18 hours, 20 hours, 24 hours. But the average tended to be about 20 hours a week. And I said, okay, great. Here's a follow-up question. How many of you in the room genuinely has 20 hours a week to train? And no one put their hand up. So how are we successful? And interesting, the last two athletes that we've had win their age group in Hawaii have both been CEOs. And so they're very, very busy people. And their average training hours have been between 12 and 14 hours a week. And now, physically talented guys with very big engines. But the key message there is not, oh, 12 hours a week is all you need to do to win your age group in Hawaii. It's that with these very talented athletes who have very busy lives, that managed to achieve really good results in the world championships. If I had have given them the more stereotypical program of, here you go, boys, go and get 18 to 20 hours a week, I promise you they would have failed. And so there's a discussion that you're talking about has become a little easier for us because we keep sort of showing the results. I don't mean that in a big-headed way, but it empowers athletes to come on board and say, hang on, I appreciate it. But yeah, you're dead right, Simon. It's that initial conversation of the program will not work if the athlete doesn't buy in, and the athlete cannot buy in if they don't understand, appreciate, and are empowered to execute as you hope them to do. It's a big part of coaching.
Yeah, I think you worked with Sammy Inkinen for a while, didn't you, Matt?
Sammy the Bull, indeed. Yeah. I worked with Sammy all the way through his triathlon career and still do. Still very good friends.
And I mean, I've posted quite a few people to, you know, the articles about Sammy, about his winning his age group in Kona and, you know, less than 10 hours a week on average. I mean, clearly he's a very, very talented athlete, but actually if you met him, you'd be surprised at how big he is. I saw him running down a lead drive while I was walking along during the race. And I'm thinking, who the hell's this huge guy coming here? And it was Sammy Inkinen. He doesn't fit like the stereotypical mold, does he, of a triathlete?
He looks like a Russian tank driver. And, I mean, the good thing about the wonderful thing about Sami, so yes, he has lungs the size of an elephant and he is extremely talented. He's incredibly pragmatic and he was willing, really in many ways, Sami is our sort of poster boy of optimized training because he was at that time, he'd just founded Trulia, the real estate search engine.
Yeah.
And obviously the CEO of that company, extremely busy. And so we were forced into a cul-de-sac to say, hang on, we're looking to achieve sort of all of these results in triathlon, but this is the reality of your life. And so it forced out-of-the-box thinking. It's like, how do we optimize this? Because we can't create hours that aren't there. And he's a prime example that if I had have asked him to do 16 hours, the more training stimulus would only have led to failure. And it doesn't mean that. So the key thing with Sami is it's not that 10 hours a week is all you need to do to be great. He has physical attributes. It's that we have to optimize training within context of your life. And so even when we think about goals, the mission of, you know, for less talented athletes, you can't find time that isn't there. You have to look for performance within context of your life. And you can do a lot if you are pragmatic. And I think that one of the things that Sami could do that we always really encourage is to come out of the weeds. So not look at any single week of training as being defining, not look at any single session, but looking at stringing together many, many hours over many, many months. And if you're doing 10 hours a week for 30 weeks, well, you can do the math. That's a lot of training to get ready for a single day. We're not getting ready for the Tour de France. You're getting ready for a single day event. And so you can accumulate resilience. And then if it manifests itself with freshness, you have an opportunity to have a great day of racing.
Yeah, I love that whole principle. And what you're talking about there really, Matt, is consistency, isn't it? And I can remember when I first started triathlon back in the late 80s, I was on a training camp with a guy called Bernie Shrewsbury. I don't know if you ever came across Bernie. He was a top class racer in the UK. He was in the special forces, but I wrote it down in my little notebook and I've still got it now. And it says consistency is the key to success. And you know, what you're saying there is absolutely one of my messages too, is if there's no point in doing 14 or 15 hours a week if you can only do it for 6 weeks and then you're injured for 3 weeks because you've really done two steps forward and one step back. But if you can do that 10 hours you talk about, manage it, recover from it, make small progress. If you put together 15 weeks of small steps, you end up three times as far down the road as if you do two big ones and one backwards. And I think what you're saying there is that people like Sammy and some of your other examples that you talk about show that this method works and is worth following. I think that part of it is a lot of the guys are just too frightened to try it. There's this myth about large number of hours, particularly if you're doing long distance, and that for whatever reason, because for me, you know, what's the worst that can go wrong is if you train less and you get better, that's a win all the way around. And if you train more and get injured, that's a loss all the way around. But but it beats me why more people aren't confident enough to try it unless they see the evidence that you're providing there with some of your athletes.
Yeah, no one finishes the line and gets penalized for not training enough. And no one gets extra time bonuses because they did extra training. And it's really about the use of time. And look, if there's nothing wrong with mileage, there's nothing wrong with big miles. In fact, some of our professionals, that's a great British triathlete that we've worked with for a long time, Laura Siddle, that many of the listeners will know. She obviously is a professional. She has a lot of time and tends to do more training hours because she's a really resilient athlete that absorbs mileage very well, but also has time to recuperate, time to sleep, time to plan her eating and eat well. But, you know, if Laura then decided to go and get a quote real job, then her training methodology would have to apply because we cannot ignore stress. Stress is stress. It's there. And it's keeping a clear head on that. And a great example, and I use these, I think we can learn from the pros if we apply the lessons to amateurs. So I'm sort of talking about the pros as a tool to learn for the amateurs. And even at the world-class level, I remember, you know, when I first started working with Chris Lieto, he was a big volume guy, 30 hours a week, every week. And I said, great, Chris, we're going to lean into that. This is back in 2008 now. We're going to lean into that, but we're going to reduce your training volume by a third. We're going to go in 20 to 22 hours a week at most. We're going to increase your caloric intake by 1,000 to 1,500 calories. We're going to integrate strength and conditioning. We're going to maximize recovery. And he kicked and screamed, but to his favor, he bought off on it and he did it. Now he had this great background and base. But the ironic thing is that year, 2009, which was the year that he got second at the Hawaii Ironman, he was averaging 20 to 22 hours a week. And yet he accumulated more hours than he had in any of his seasons of 30 hour week. And that's because he was never injured. And he was never fatigued. And so there was no yo-yo effect. He just created that magic word consistency. And of course, he showed up to Hawaii that year. And I'll never forget, he in race week, he said, after this, can we go to Ironman Arizona? And I thought, oh, you're ready to have a good one. Because if you're already excited about the next race, you're fresh. And it happened for him.
Matt, you've written two books. You've talked quite a bit about optimizing training for busy people, and you've done, and we'll put something about this in the show notes. You've done the Fast Track Triathlete, but the first book of yours I bought was because I come from a strength and conditioning background. You were one of the first people that was coaching that I'd read that actually was focusing on athletes prioritizing their strength and conditioning. You know, I've got a book in my cupboard that comes back from the 80s and 90s, and in there, there are some people, and Brett Sutton's quoted as saying, you know, you don't need to do strength and conditioning. It's okay to pedal the hills in a big gear and use hand paddles. And I tore my hair out almost reading this and put the book in the back of the cupboard and didn't read it again. But I pulled it out again recently. I was looking through it, and there again is this message that I'd underlined in red, sort of staring and screaming at me. But I liked your message of, you know, the importance of strength and conditioning, you know, throughout the year. And how to integrate that. And, you know, you've mentioned that athletes generally don't fail in their races and blow up because of fitness. I also think that when you see them falling apart at the end of the race, you've got a phrase in your little dictionary, haven't you, about a donkey in concrete or something. But for me, when you see people running like that and falling apart, it's not because their lungs are giving up and they can't breathe. It's because the body work is just shutting down and not really supporting the engine. So can we talk about strength and conditioning and how much of a priority and a value you put on that in an athlete's resilience?
I think there's the word resilience. It's wonderful. I would call it a critical supplement. And again, integrated into the program. So the type of strength and conditioning that you're maybe doing at this time of the year as we speak, as we go into the winter months, and more sort of, as I call post-season, many people call off-season, all the way through to the early part of the year, it might have a different personality than at the racing time, where it's a bit more explosive and also therapeutic in nature, making sure that you're sort of keeping joint mobility, et cetera, but the key component for us of all athletes, from professional all the way down to contemplators, strength and conditioning is a year-round, always present component of training. And we integrate it into the program in a very, especially for time-starved individuals, in a pragmatic, sensible approach to not dilute too much of the bullseye, which is swim, bike, and run for triathletes, but it has to be present. And for me, it's not because of the tired old sort of excuse of being preventative. Yeah, there may be a preventative element of having an athlete do strength and conditioning where potentially it reduces the occurrence of injuries. But I think about it in terms of being a performance enhancer. Synchronization of movement. Most triathletes, if you ask them to take their finger and touch their nose, they'll poke themselves in the eye. So opening the gateway for biomechanical improvements, muscle recruitment, and getting more fibers into the usable mix. And then as you talk about retention of posture and form, which is a massive economy challenge, and the resistance to mechanical fatigue, which is the primary limiter in Ironman racing, is no doubt in my mind fosters and improved with the presence of strength and conditioning. Now we can carry on this and talk about many of the people that are doing the sport, the aging athlete, the maturing athlete, and the role of strength and conditioning in that. The premenopausal woman that's just about to lose 50% of her bone density postmenopause becomes an absolutely critical supplement for those athletes. Yeah, maybe a 22-year-old whippet that's got a big engine and can get away with it. Maybe it has a less of a priority, but I would still argue is still absolutely important. It's just it is a part of the program. We don't have a professional athlete all the way down to an amateur athlete that bypasses it. And I think it's become more and more accepted. And if you look at the successful professional athletes and all the way down, strength and conditioning is becoming an ever increasing priority. It will never get in front of the bullseye, swim, bike, and run. That's what we have to do. But it is the gateway to maximize that. And the final thing I'll say, Simon, is that the one thing that I would urge the mindset, though, is that athletes cannot go to the gym, do strength, and then forget about it. It's only really effective if they bridge emotionally and practically the exercises that they're doing in the gym and in some way bridge to the exercises that they're doing outside, which is swimming, cycling, and running. So that stuff you mentioned, big gear work on the bike, hill running, tethered swimming, etc., is really, really valuable. It's really valuable, and that acts as the bridge between what you're doing in the gym or at home relative to what you're doing at the field.
Yeah, I used to also try and explain it that, you know, if you're doing some form of resistance training, not only are you working movements and all of those things you mentioned, you know, biomechanical improvement and what have you, but you're strengthening connective tissue. And so if you've already strengthened those tendons and ligaments, because they're the ones that tend to get affected by the overuse and the repetitive motions in triathlon, if you can strengthen those connective tissues, then when you start to do your big gear work, when you start to run hills, or when you start to do the tethered swimming or the paddles, those connective tissues are going to be able to withstand those increased stresses, and so you're less likely to get injured. Hence, you know, adding to this whole consistency that we've been talking about.
And I would argue as well, optimize the yield, the adaptation yield from that work that you're doing. What I do, I'm not a strength and conditioning expert. What I do is try and surround myself with smart people. I need to be surrounded by people like you, Simon.
that's an interesting point you make there, Matt, because within our club, somebody was asking the question, you know, do I need to have raced at a high level and do I need to be an expert in all these things to be a triathlon coach? And one of my points of response was, actually you need to have some basic technical knowledge, but what you need to do is surround yourself with a network of experts who make you look good and introduce them, and that'll enhance your coaching, and you can learn off them. You know, you don't need to wait until you become an expert in all of those. Otherwise, you'll never get started in coaching because there's too much to learn.
Well, that's it. And I feel very strongly that I have areas in my coaching where I just, there are much better people than me in that area. So I'd much rather try and go out and surround myself with them and learn from them and sometimes bring them on board if I can. And that's really important. And I think as coaching, as soon as you think you've got it all worked out, you're done. So it's time to reply. I think we're always learning, and that's why sort of doing shows like this where we can have a coach's chat, as it were, but also learn from each other is incredibly valuable. But yeah, I really believe in trying to surround yourself with people that are smarter than you in areas that maybe you're not so strong in.
You've probably seen this, Matt. I know you're a well-read guy, but the Dunning-Kruger model. Or graph. So you start out by thinking, I know it all. We probably both know coaches that think I know it all. And then they get to the point where they go, oh, actually, there's more to this than I thought. And so as they start to learn more, their confidence drops until they get right to the very bottom. And then they start to get an upward slope where they think, oh, I'm actually starting to get it now. And then eventually they're never quite back at that high confidence, arrogance level with no knowledge, where they think, actually, do you know what? It's actually more complicated than I thought, but I'm getting there. And for most of the coaches, the good coaches that I know, and probably the good coaches that you know as well, they remain feet firmly planted on the ground, very humble about what they know, and always trying to learn more, and realizing that the more they learn, the more they realize there is to learn.
Yeah, it's evolve or die. I mean, I can give you a very clear example of something that I thought was wonderful to see. You know, if you think about in the triathlon space, the best known swimming resources, probably the two guys that are the most well known internationally are probably Paul Newsome from Swim Smooth and Jerry Rodriguez from Tower 26. Two, yeah. Obviously very good field. You stand alone, sort of probably the best two guys. And a couple of months ago, I saw that Paul was on Jerry's podcast,
yeah,
discussing swimming. I mean, it doesn't get any better. There's two guys that are at the top of their field, still eager to grow and learn. And that's, you know, I have very, very strong beliefs on what and believe in what I believe in. But at the same time, we have this very strong statement of evolve or die. And we spend this time of the year, myself and the coaching team, ripping ourselves to pieces of where do we go wrong? How do we learn? How do we improve? And going outside, asking our athletes, asking other experts, how can we improve this? Because as soon as you think that you've got it all worked out, that's when it becomes very uninteresting and it's a coach to run away from.
If you had an athlete stood in front of you now and they're asking you for some guidance on what they should be doing for the winter, can you give us 3 to 5 global things that they can prioritize and be thinking about right now?
Yes.
From the Matt Dixon dictionary.
Once they've taken a little break, 2 or 3 weeks, where they've sort of turned their back on structured training, I think that we call it post-season.
Yep.
But I think it's the most critical phase for any athlete looking to really go through to another level is the next couple of months of training. And I call it preparatory in nature. So it dovetails nicely off of your point, Simon, that when you talked about sort of strengthening the tissues and muscles, this part of the year is a fantastic time to work on technical development. And that might be your position on the bike and the equipment changes, but also obviously improving technique across the disciplines. But parallel to that, going through a very focused and progressive preparatory phase of training, about 6 to 9 weeks in duration, where you're not looking to gain massive fitness, you're not looking to track performance gains, but instead you're looking to prepare the tendons, muscles, and ligaments for the very hard work that's coming in the new year. And if you go through that, so we introduce what we call end of range training, lower end cadence biking, some higher end cadence biking, first strength based running, hill based running, but all with a technical doing well focus, and getting athletes to then also do some stuff that's away from the sport a little bit, mountain biking, cross biking, hiking for those in the States, cross country skiing and things like that. But giving yourself a little bit of latitude to have some of your training be fun and unstructured, and then the specific stuff be very preparatory in nature. And if you prevent yourself from getting too fit, but you are ready, emotionally fresh and physically robust for you then to hit the heavy lifting, as it were, the hard work that's coming in the winter months and spring months of January, February, March, April, that's when you're going to take the big performance yield forward. So patience, freedom, and preparation is the phase of training that we're in right now.
Wow. Patience, freedom, and prep. Love that.
I pulled that saying out of my behind, by the way.
I was trying to think of the phrases that Dan Plews and Paul Larson use, but it's escaped me now. Health, longevity, performance, I think, is their slogan on there. Yeah.
Just two smart guys as well, by the way.
Yeah, I had Paul on the show. I've known Dan for a long time. I used to coach Dan, actually, when he was in the UK, we were running the talent squad here in Leeds. And I've known Dan for quite a long time. And Paul was on the show last week, actually. So a lot of good stuff. I had one question for you. You can do this as a yes or a no. Everything you've talked about managing your athletes, do you see yourself as a triathlon coach, or do you see yourself as a life coach for triathletes?
That's a great question. Both.
And that's a great answer.
A life coach sounds very American of you, by the way, Simon. I didn't know that had permeated the UK yet. But yeah, I think it's life development and helping people. I like to help people thrive.
Yeah, I do like your approach, Matt, and I'm sure that we are going to have lots of questions about everything we've talked about. I listened to a podcast you did recently where you were talking about the nutrition of one of your athletes and how you help them mold their nutrition to get a better performance. And sadly, we've not been able to talk about that today, but maybe we can get you on after Christmas. We can chat about what comes in the new year after this prep phase, and maybe we can hone in on nutrition a little bit more, because I know that's another of your purple patch pillars of performance.
But I'd love to, Simon, and love to be back. And you know, not to be too pluggy, but our podcast, the Purple Patch Podcast, we do it as purely education. That's our mission. So yeah, listeners can certainly go if they want to hear about nutrition in advance. But I'd be more than happy to come back on and have another chat.
Well, like you mentioned earlier with Paul and Jerry chatting, Matt, you know, my mission too is one of educating the triathletes, of sharing the knowledge that other coaches have been gracious enough to share with me. You know, we're only custodians of it after all, and somebody's got to come after us. I have no ego problem about having you. You know, some people might say that I see you as a competitor in the coaching world or on the podcast, but I don't at all. It's great to have you on the show. I appreciate you sharing your time with us and your knowledge. And we will signpost people to your podcast, to your books, and to your website, and anything else you'd like to let me know about. We'll certainly help share some of that knowledge amongst some of the listeners. So
awesome.
Yeah, Matt.
So much, really.
Yeah, really appreciate your time, Matt. I'm aware of the fact that you've got to go off and do some more stuff now. So thank you very much for being on the show today. Listeners, as always, thank you for joining us. I promise you great guests. I'm sure you'll agree that Matt's been fantastic with his with the conversation today. So thank you for listening. We'll be back soon with more great guests. But for now, thank you for me and thank you for Matt. That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWAT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose, and for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon
and swim run events. As a SWAP member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year. And on top of that, we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover, and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWAT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page, and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWAT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.